I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Working men of all countries unite, wrote the brash young philosopher-journalist Karl Marx, 29 years old, almost penniless, on the run from German and French police, new to London in 1848. He said, "Let the ruling classes tremble at a communistic revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win." And so the mythic monster, the man and his ism, found first full voice in a manifesto of aphorisms that can sound Shakespearean to some modern ears, almost scriptural in authority, or chilling or challenging to others. Here's how Hollywood's Ronald Reagan, an actor in transition, treated Marx in 1962.
Karl Marx, who developed the basic theories of communism, was a sick man most of his life, sick in body and spirit. He once said, "The capitalists will pay for my carbuncles." We have.
But the terms keep turning. This very week, Hillary Clinton said her presidential campaign was poisoned, not least by her being labeled a capitalist.
I mean, if you're in the Iowa caucuses and 41% of Democrats are self-described socialists, and I'm asked, "Are you a capitalist?" And I say, "Yes, but with appropriate regulation," that probably gets lost in the, "Oh my gosh, she's a capitalist."
Karl Marx's 200th birthday is our hook, as they say in the news game. What hooks us, though, is the glaring relevance, as Luke Menand put it in The New Yorker, of Marx's working world and ours. It's as if in the din of the Industrial Revolution in Europe, Marx was noting down the roots of our own digital transformation today. His precarious labor is our full-blown precariat. His maldistribution of goodies is more extreme now and global. Fragility, uncertainty, arbitrary unfairness are main marks of a genie economy that's out of the bottle, out of the sorcerer's control. Also this hour, we'll get to Marx, the gentle genius at home in a bourgeois family, the obsessive scholar trying to dope out a science of society at the very moment Charles Darwin was mapping a new science of biological nature. Then there's Marxism today in the toolkit of black politics and feminism. The omnicritic Terry Eagleton gets us started, prolific Englishman with Irish Republican roots. He was shaped by Marxism and Catholicism. In his politics and his religion, Terry Eagleton says he's not vastly different from himself as a 16-year-old altar boy. After the 2008 economic crisis, Terry Eagleton's book was Why Marx Was Right, under 10 main headings like class, violence, and utopia.
We got Marx wrong in all sorts of ways. I mean, one is that we think that he reduced everything to the economic. He didn't. Marx was a great humanist in the Central European humanist tradition. And he actually was very bored by his economic work. He would much have preferred to write a book on Goethe. He was wanting to write a big book on Balzac. He was wanting to write a book on ethics. But he thought that what he once called all this economic crap, he thought that it was irresponsible of him to leave that aside, because he thought that in that lay something of a key to the awful poverty and destitution that he found around him in Victorian London. Another misapprehension: he didn't think in terms of the collective. He sometimes talked about that, but he was very concerned with the uniqueness of the individual. And much of his work is about the free development of individual lives, what he calls the flourishing of individuals, and what material conditions would be necessary for everybody to have a chance of developing what he calls their powers and capacities. He's concerned with what Aristotle calls well-being, the good life. What would it take, what material transformations would it take for as many men and women as possible to be happy? And he doesn't think that's possible under capitalism.
Terry, Marx is all about work, then and now. I mean, it's alienation of labor, the frustration of happiness in exploitation. He would be fascinated by our gig economy, by what technology keeps doing to human beings. Bring him into the modern world on work.
People think very often, don't they, that Marx is about labor. That's another misconception. Marxism isn't about labor, it's about leisure. Yes?
I mean, the rest
Marx
of the day.
Writes, yes, it's about leisure. By the way, the great majority of the working class when he was writing were not male production, blue-collar workers. They were domestic servants. And the vast majority of domestic servants were women. So Marx knew perfectly well, when he talked about the working class, that he wasn't talking about, the horny-handed sons of toil. He was talking mainly about women. And one very vital part of Marx's analysis is that he wants a radical shortening of the working day so that people can be freed from toil to do whatever they want. And he's not interested in what it may be they choose to do. But you can't do that under an intensely competitive capitalism, which needs to squeeze profit out of each worker every moment of the day, so that the technology which he believed could, in principle, free men and women, actually is used to intensify their exploitation.
We'll come back to the humanism, but how do we sail over the wasteland of Stalinism, of insane state power?
We don't sail over the wasteland of Stalinism. In fact, one has to take that fact extremely seriously. I mean, the fact is that that monstrous defamation, distortion of Marx's work, which we call Stalinism, has made the idea of socialism stink, quite frankly, in the nostrils of many, many people who would have benefited from it otherwise. Despite that awful legacy, socialism is such a brilliant idea. The idea of cooperating rather than conflicting and competing, the idea of sharing resources on an equitable basis, the idea of collective participation in building our social life is, in my view, such a wonderful idea that even given the terrible setbacks it's taken, not only by Stalinism, but also today, where Marxists are pretty thin on the ground, let's face it, that the idea of socialism hasn't perished. The idea of socialism tends to return.
Come back to economics. You say he scorned economics, but you could also make the argument that his description, even in the Communist Manifesto, of a explosively fertile, disruptive, organic, powerful bourgeois capitalism describes our world in 2018 even more than it did his in 1848.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things about the Communist Manifesto, which incidentally is the single most influential document in 19th century Europe, okay? Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about it is, well, two things. One is globalization. Communist Manifesto predicts that the capitalist system will become global. And secondly, it predicts that there will be an increasing polarity between rich and poor, which, if you look at the world on a total scale, is of course the case. Now, what Marx was interested in was what are the mechanisms which create that distinction? I mean, is it just an accident, that in the most affluent and prosperous society which has ever existed in human civilization, we have people going hungry, we have people begging, and so on, or are there certain concealed mechanisms, structures, which continually generate this situation?
There's a piece of Marx that fascinates me, and that is as a sort of separated at birth brother of Charles Dickens. As a social reporter, Dickens of Bleak House, Dickens of the poor and the neglected in London of the 1850s and 60s.
Yes. I'm speaking to you from Chris, from a hotel in Lancaster in England, which Dickens used to visit quite often.
really?
And indeed, behind me is a great four-poster bed, which he might even have slept in.
Would he like to speak to us, Terry? Does he have a word for us?
He's very shy. He's terribly coy about the media. Interestingly, I don't think that Marx and Dickens ever met, which is odd. I mean, they were both, of course, at the height of their powers in the 1850s and 1860s in Victorian London. And also, although, of course, Dickens is incomparable at, wringing our heartstrings over the dreadful aspects of Victorian society, we have to remember also that Dickens thought that however bad Victorian England was, it was a hell of a lot better than anything that had gone before. Yes. And we have to remember also that Dickens politically was a fairly mild reformist who actually sent his sons to Eton, the major private school in Britain. So, you know, there are important political differences between himself and Marx, though I have to admit that Marx's wife was of aristocratic German descent, and Marx was rather foolishly proud of, you know, her poshness, of that she was a sort of patrician. So he even, you know, Marx's politics weren't perfect either. But of course, he was also a down-at-heel Jewish refugee who had been hunted around Europe, who had been persecuted by various European states, including his own, who washed up in a very broken-down part of London. And his family survived, of course, but he was very poor himself. In fact, he once said, nobody had written so much about money and had so little.
Come back to Marx's idea of a good life, including family life. Yeah. He dispenses with family and marriage in the manifesto, but he also lived a long, rich relationship at home.
Marx, of course, was, as I say, a domestic man, but his actual, if you like, his ethical ideal can be expressed in one very important sentence in the Communist Manifesto, which is, he believes in the free development of each as a condition of the free development of all. Now, that's very interesting because, of course, liberalism believes in the free development of each, but not, but as it were, each doing his or her own thing. Marx's idea of free development, or if you like, what he calls self-realization, is reciprocal. That's to say, you have to realize the self in and through the self-realization of others. And if you take that on a personal level, on an interpersonal level, the idea of realizing the self through and in the self-realization of somebody else is commonly known as love. That's what love is, yeah? Two people whose self-realization happens very much in terms of the others. Now, in a way, what Marx is looking for is a political equivalent of love, or what some theorists have called political love. What would that look like at the level of a whole society?
Terry Eagleton's new book from Yale is called Radical Sacrifice. Coming up, Marx, the revolutionary at his reading room desk in the British Museum, and at home in a family that adored him almost too much. This is Open Source. Marxism, early on, became a cottage industry among white men parsing phrases and doctrines, no matter that the burden of the system they studied was falling on women and black and brown workers out of all proportion. The American biographer Mary Gabriel breaks that mold on an ancient theory that the way to take the measure of a great man is to follow him home. What she found was a trove of family letters around an ostensibly conventional home, wife and daughters who worshipped the obsessive, often contrary man of the house. He makes a rich, complex, deeply sad life story, blighted by two, some say three, suicides among the daughters who would have done anything for him. Mary Gabriel spoke to us this week from the west of Ireland.
People have a tendency to write about Marx's family as if this was a massive sacrifice, you know, that he dragged the family down with them into this pit of poverty while he was busy constructing a theory that would come to be known as Marxism. But the fact was that their lives were incredibly rich. They weren't in any way rich materially, but the exchanges that they had among themselves and the intellectual caliber of their lives was so high and so rich that they never felt, the daughters especially, never really felt at all beleaguered by the life that their father led and that they, by necessity as 19th century women, led as well.
You find him in an entirely bourgeois relationship with Jenny. He's a father, a husband, not absolutely faithful, but dedicated. It's a serious marriage. What does that tell you about the doctrine or his writing, his obsession with revolution, with his own career as a writer?
If Marx hadn't been tethered to this family, I don't think he could have done what he did, and also tethered to Engels, who supported him both intellectually and materially. But I think if Marx didn't have the cushion of his family, he wouldn't have been able to go so far out on a limb. He really needed to be bound to reality through them. And in fact, there's one case where after a really tragic death in his family, the death of their favorite son, Edgar, Jenny took the daughters and went off to see her mother and kind of traveled around Europe a bit just to recover because she thought it would be too depressing for them to stay at home. And as soon as they left London, though Marx complained to Engels about the noise of the household and the hubbub and the, you know, the bills that mounted because of the girls and feeding everyone in the family, as soon as they left, he went totally to pieces. His letters are hilarious. He started dissecting words in Shakespeare and coming up with all kinds of illnesses that he was sure he was suffering. It was almost the moment they left the door, he couldn't handle himself. You know, alone with himself, he couldn't be Karl Marx. But as long as he was in the midst of family chaos, you know, the hubbub of everyday life, he could function.
That's utterly fascinating and funny and so human. Here he is dismissing family and the bondage of marriage in the manifesto, for example, and he never even noted, oh, by the way, I could never have done this thing without my wife, Jenny, and my faithful, stimulating family.
Yeah, exactly. I felt the only place to really find him would be to follow him home, to be there among his family, and to read his candid letters, you know, to his friends, to his family, to Engels, and the letters that they wrote each other. I felt that if there's an honesty to be found in Marx's life, you would find it there.
There are thousands of those letters in your book. Give us one.
Here's one letter that Marx wrote Engels. In 1845, he met Friedrich Engels in Paris, and they're both German, but they hadn't known each other there, and Engels was this incredible bon vivant, son of a manufacturer, brilliant man, but he was the exact opposite of Marx. You know, he was a bachelor, loved women, he loved to ride horses, he loved the hunt. You know, Marx was this kind of stumbling, slightly overweight family man, you know, very untidy in his dress, eternally buried in books. And Engels was a man who loved life to the fullest. And Engels decided, he was also an ex-military man, and he decided that he would enlist in Marx's cause, basically, because he believed politically what Marx was saying, and he thought Marx was brilliant and needed a protector. So Engels sort of fell on his sword and decided to work at his father's manufacturing plant in Manchester, England, which was the hub of industrial Europe at that time. And by working for his father, he would then support the Marx family. And so he did that for actually all of his life. And in fact, after Marx's death, he continued to support Marx's daughter. But in 1865, so this is 20 years after they met, you know, Marx is once again turning to Engels for money. Now, this is, you know, thousands of pounds down the road, and he's still asking for cash. And Marx says to Engels, "I assure you that I would rather have my thumb cut off than write this letter to you. It is truly soul-destroying to be dependent for half one's life. The only thought that sustains me in all this is that the two of us form a partnership together, in which I spend my time on the theoretical and party side of the business. It is true my house is beyond my means, and we have, moreover, lived better this year than was the case before. But it is the only way for the children to establish themselves socially, with a view to securing their future, quite apart from everything they've suffered and for which they have at least been compensated for a brief while. I believe you yourself would be of the opinion that, even from a merely commercial point of view, to run a purely proletarian household would not be appropriate in the circumstances, although that would be quite all right if my wife and I were by ourselves or if the girls were boys." And I think this goes to the question about kind of the feminist look at Marx. It's another duality in his life and in his philosophy. He absolutely adored his daughters and counted on them, bouncing off ideas, expected them to follow him down the political path he chose, respected them enormously for their writings and for their political activity. And yet, he always thought of them as the girls. And he always thought of them as, you know, having to marry up. And he thought of part of his duty as a father was to prepare them for marriage, which would then secure them a better life. And so while he was fully aware that he had created three powerhouses in his daughters, he also, because he was a 19th century man, undercut them in many ways by treating them as would a father in that environment.
So interesting. Do we call this conflicted? Do we call it hypocritical? Do we call it human?
I think it's human, and I think that's the beauty of Marx. He's human to the core. He makes every mistake possible, and yet somehow he perseveres. So while he's stumbling around personally and in his own life, he's able to focus in this way that is truly remarkable. And it's the way an artist focuses. You know, they rise above their petty concerns and somehow manage to get back to that place where they can create.
I'm just fascinated by Marx's own sort of street corner observation of workers, people, poor people, any people in the London of the 1850s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
As a social reporter.
Yes. Marx was basically a journalist, and that's what makes his writing so exciting. And so his life in London fed him, you know, the imagery he needed. The statistics he got from government reports in the library meant nothing until he was out on the street roaming around his neighborhood, which was full of immigrants from many countries. And it was those visuals and interactions with those people which really put the flesh on the bones of the statistics that he'd been studying. And what we have to remember is that when Marx arrived in London in 1850, the 1848 revolts in Europe, which were kind of like the Arab Spring during our time, it was a massive upheaval throughout the European continent that had caused a huge refugee crisis. And many, many of those refugees found their way to London because Britain had an open door policy and they were escaping the continent. So when Marx arrived, Soho, Dean Street, Clerkenwell, which was the Italian kind of ghetto, were teeming with refugees. And there wasn't obviously enough housing to house them all. So they set up encampments in alleys and in back, you know, sort of refuse areas. It was in every way what Dickens might have said, the worst of times and the best of times. It was a desperate place. But for a social historian, for a journalist, for a philosopher, there was no better place to record what man was capable of, what men had done to other men, and also what this new system, which is as yet hadn't even been named capitalism, was doing to society. You know, the mass expulsions of people from the continent, it was a reaction to the beginning of capitalism because these people were made desperate by factories that were taking over small shops, farms that they had labored on forever that had been turned into industrial farms and no longer needed them. So really, he was experiencing the first mass migration based on capitalism. And so it was a perfect place for Marx to discover what this system held in store.
As you describe him watching this rocket rise of capitalism, this spectacle of everything changing. I mean, it's a lot of the way we feel about the digital revolution. What the heck? It's changing everything.
Exactly. And that's it. And when you're in the midst of it, as Marx was, you don't really know what's happening. And that's what's so incredible. When you read the Communist Manifesto or his 1844 manuscripts, which he wrote in Paris, when he was really just beginning to dabble in economics, he had no idea what he was grappling with, and yet he had a remarkably clear and prescient idea of where this system, this, you know, vague sort of change, like the one we're living through today, he sort of threw his mind forward into the future, not a decade or not 2 decades or not 50 years, but almost a century forward, and could predict fairly accurately where we were going. And that's what I think is the true genius of Marx, that he didn't really ever come up with a system for society. You know, what is the optimum system? He was more of a diagnostician. He said, this is what the disease is, which was eventually called capitalism. This is how it's going to hurt you. What he never did was come up with a prescription to say, take this pill, you'll be much better. And I think that's what happened in the 20th century. You know, there was no pathway that he provided. So his words and his ideas were out there, but they were there to be transformed in any way any particular government needed. And that's, I think, why his work was so easily distorted. You live in the fog of the present, and that's what Marx did.
Mary Gabriel, will you digress, as you do in the book, on this amazing moment, 1859, when Charles Darwin publishes On the Origin of Species. It sold out overnight. And he's struggling with Das Kapital. We think of these two incredible breakthrough books, sort of scientific, sort of everything. And Jenny, bless her heart, thought, wait, maybe Carl's got a bestseller in him too.
Yeah, Darwin was over there writing this, and it was a huge hit. And Jenny read about it, and she was thrilled because she knew that Marx was on the verge of completing Kapital, or so she thought. He would often tell her that he was on the verge of finishing, and in fact, he was, you know, years away. But in any case, when he finally did finish it in 1867 and he found a publisher, she was so convinced that this would change the world. She was breathless in anticipation. She would write friends and say, you know, the bomb is going to drop on the bourgeoisie now. You know, the world will never be the same. Well, in fact, when that book was published, not only did it not change the world, it barely created a ripple. No one read it. It was partly Marx's fault because the format that he chose to write in, he was so anxious to get it out of his head, you know, where it had been living for so many years, that one of his paragraphs was 200 pages long. Now, his material was difficult enough to grasp because it was a completely new subject written in a completely new way. But who on earth has the patience to read a book that is written without the slightest regard for the reader? So for the average reader in 1867 Germany to get this text, you know, it dropped like a bomb, all right. No one wanted to touch it. It really wasn't until 1883, after Marx's death, that anyone started to discover him. And that only happened because his book was translated into French. And young people in France were much more advanced politically than young people in England or Germany. And they actually read this and saw, you know, what this man was up to and what the possibilities were.
Mary Gabriel, I got to say, your book, Love and Capital, is the book on Marx at his 200th birthday. But stand back a moment. I take you as something of a red diaper baby from Minnesota, the American Midwest. What did you learn? What are we all learning about Karl Marx at home, as well as his work? His writing.
I hope that readers today who read my book or who read many of the books that have been written about Marx, because there's a resurgence of interest in him, will come away with the idea that the Marx we've grown up with in the 20th century, the Marx connected to Soviet communism, or who we've been taught to loathe, if not fear, that Marx has actually nothing to do with the Marx of the 19th century, the Marx who was at his dining table with his family, the Marx who toiled away in the British Library, the Marx who worked 16 years to produce Das Kapital. That Marx is a man who we can all relate to, who has very much to teach us. And unfortunately, his words and his works were so distorted on all sides of the political divide in the 20th century that he was really lost. I actually went into my book having an extremely low opinion of Marx. Not that I objected to him politically, but what I had read about him personally, I thought that he was just a really selfish bastard and that he had put his family through hell. I came out of the book, out of 8 years of research, having an incredibly deep appreciation of not just Marx's work, but Marx the man. When you're dealing with a genius, you have to cut them a lot of slack. Marx himself would say about poets, you know, they're not normal men. They shouldn't be held to the same standards of average men. And I think that's true of all geniuses. You have to accept them for who they are and the good with the bad. And only when you understand the good and the bad and then appreciate them in the context of their work do you really come away with a greater understanding of what they were doing, who they were. And only then can they enrich your lives. And I think he actually gave me hope for the future, because I saw how he struggled and what he produced. And I saw the situation in which he worked and the people around him and how difficult social and political change was for them. They were dealing with kings who were thought to be emissaries from God. You know, how do you confront that? They were dealing with centuries-old monarchies and who they hoped to overthrow. And in fact, they did it.
Mary Gabriel, I wonder what you were looking for, what you found as a woman in a guy field, a white guy field of hair splitting around Marxist analysis, but also looking for clues from Marx about women and brown people who were the principal, most numerous victims of the capitalism he watched.
The story of Marx has been a story told by white men, largely. And
right.
In fact, I think it was important to have a woman's voice telling the Marx story, because women look at Marx from a different point of view. As far as Marx's treatment of women, both intellectually and actually personally, as a 19th century intellectual, he really wasn't that concerned about women. They factored in his personal life, you know, hugely. And they were part of the story he told because the industrial system in England that he was using as his example of what capitalism do with society was peopled by women who were women and children who were doing terribly difficult jobs, earning, you know, a fraction of what the men were earning, and they were being worked to death and chewed up in this system. So he knew that the capitalist system was destroying family life, destroying women and children, but he wasn't particularly a protector of women. He didn't separate women out from his general message. He's been criticized for not being sufficiently feminist, but I don't really think that's fair because you have to look at when he was writing, when he was working. You know, he was in every way a middle-class Prussian intellectual. And so what would his focus have been? It would have been on trying to convince other men, you know, that of the validity of his theories and of the validity of his findings. But throughout his books, throughout Capital, the characters who he uses to describe capitalist excesses are women and children. And the worst excesses, he thinks, are perpetrated on those victims. So I think he was, in some ways, a defender of women, but just not in an overt way.
Mary Gabriel's book is titled Love and Capital. Coming up, a taste of what Black and feminist activists in our day can and cannot learn from Karl Marx. This is Open Source. Robin D. G. Kelly is an influential cultural historian based now at UCLA. He's a student of 20th century Black struggle, a biographer who broke through the mystery of jazz genius Thelonious Monk, and all the while an unorthodox Marxist in motion, in the direction of surrealism, he says now. Kelly is the authority we wanted to hear on why activism of all stripes keeps turning to the peculiar language of Marxism. Great names in Black American struggle, from W.E.B. Du Bois to Paul Robeson to Huey Newton and H. Rapp Brown, have called themselves Marxists, sometimes Maoists, sometimes communists. What did they find? I asked Robin Kelly this week, starting with a favorite of mine, the Trinidadian author C.L.R. James, the great author on the game of cricket, also on Herman Melville and his Moby Dick, also on the revolution that defeated Napoleon's army to liberate Haiti from France in 1804.
For James, you know, a lot of what he figured out by doing exactly what Marx did, that is going to the archive, studying history. Just as Marx studied the Civil War in France in 18th Brumaire, in the case of James, it was the Haitian Revolution that was his laboratory, you know. And it was through his study of the Haitian Revolution that he kind of came to the conclusion that, among other things, that the enslaved people on the plantations producing sugar were as close to a modern proletariat as any other worker in the modern world.
You know, Robin, can I say, you remind me about C.L.R. James. He was deeply involved in the weeds of left-wing argument. But he also said that what formed him was Thackeray and the novel Vanity Fair. He said, don't blame Marx. I learned everything. He learned his politics reading one of the great realistic early Victorian novels for social observation.
And that makes perfect sense for two reasons. One, coming out of Trinidad and England being the ideal for colonized people. You know, he's growing up in a world where you know, his Caribbean or African roots are not valued. What's valued is England. But then he discovers that England, the glories of England, the imperial England, masks class contradictions. So just as James found in Thackeray and found in cricket, the pathway to understanding class, I would make the argument that, you know, Marx's second half, some say better half, depending on how you look at it, Engels, came to understanding class contradictions through his enormously influential and brilliant multi-volume Condition of the English Working Class, where it was ethnography. He basically said, I'm going to study the life and world of English workers. And he did it with such precision and with kind of literary power. And so to me, that connects Engels and Marx and James and Du Bois.
I was going to say, what's the Du Bois story?
Well, one thing that they all have in common, by the way, is that they're basically novelists, you know, in a sense that, you know, none of them wrote the great novel, but they had a literary panache and an ability to tell a story that was really powerful. So if you take Du Bois's great text, I think the most important American history text ever written, Black Reconstruction in America, that is in some ways a Marxian, to use Du Bois's term, a Marxian interpretation of one of the most important revolutions in the Western Hemisphere. That is the revolution that basically led to slavery's demise, formal chattel slavery's demise in North America, and created the possibility for a true, what he calls abolition democracy. And you have Du Bois using language from his reading of Marx, like the dictatorship of the proletariat in South Carolina, for example, looking at the rise of a post-slavery working class in the countryside, building alliances with white workers. But then he goes one step further and says, well, those white workers in the South, let alone the North, basically decided to accept the wages of their race, their skin color, as being more valuable than the possibilities of class alliances and the emancipation of the proletariat. And that's one of the big tragedies. And it's not to say that Marx didn't understand this, because at the same time, and you know, look, Du Bois knew this, on the eve of the Civil War, Marx is writing articles for the New York Tribune. He makes his famous, has his famous line about, you know, labor in the white skin can never really be fully emancipated as long as labor in the black skin is branded, as long as it's enslaved. And so the emancipation of the enslaved is necessary for the emancipation of the working class as a whole. And not only did Du Bois understand this, but he read his Marx. He read those articles from the 1850s and 1860s where Marx is trying to write about the U.S. condition and the question of slavery. He reads Marx on the Irish question, on India, on the colonial condition and what it means to have a branded or bonded working class that's basically unfree, and what it means for the Western European proletariat. Marx understood that. Du Bois just goes a step further. So he reads his Marx, and he's trying to understand, you know, why is it that this experiment in democracy, what he calls abolition democracy, a democracy that would have led to massive land reform, led to the transfer of wealth and the productive forces to the working class as a whole, and could have stopped U.S. imperialism in its tracks, as far as Du Bois is concerned, why did it fail? And the Achilles heel for Du Bois was essentially race. It's more than that, but essentially race.
Robin Kelly, stand back. What did Marx know and not know about race?
Both in the Communist Manifesto, but especially in Marx's chapter on primitive accumulation in Capital, Volume 1, he talks about the first stages in development of capitalism is forms of racialized violence, you know, slavery, imperialism, empire, dispossession of the Indians, of indigenous peoples. In 1853, in the New York Tribune, he has this great quote. He says, you know, the profound hypocrisy and inherent barbarism of bourgeois civilization lies unveiled before our eyes, turning from its home where it assumes respectable forms to colonies where it goes naked.
Yeah.
So he's very, very clear about that. This is why he spent so much of his time writing about India. India as like really the jewel in the British imperial crown. At the same time, Marx's ideas are never fixed. They're not fixed. So late Marx is the one who decides, you know what, maybe this thing about the peasant, as an important motor in rebellion, moving towards socialism as possible. He looked at Russia, paid attention to Russia. He looked at North Africa. He was studying North Africa before he died, trying to understand Algeria, for example. In other words, the people who are subject to colonialism, the people who are subject to dispossession, or the people who are basically relegated to the countryside, that maybe they might have something of value in terms of what it means to develop socialism, you know, which, by the way, was never his objective. It was always about studying capital.
This question, what drives people to resist the conditions of their lives, it's so fascinating. It came up around the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, but the question was really, did the civil rights movement learn its directions from the enlightened authors of the U.S. Constitution? Were they about perfecting the U.S. Constitution? Or did Dr. King and many, many others pick up on their own lives and also on world struggle, which was already underway in the world in the 1950s? What is the use of all that baggage?
Well, see, I just lectured on this in class today, believe it or not. I do not think that the majority of the people who risked their lives in the civil rights movement were actually trying to perfect the Constitution.
Neither do I.
The question is, how do people get confidence to act? And I do think that there is a couple of things that goes on. I mean, you know, Rosa Parks is a really good example of someone who committed her life to the struggle long before she made that stand on the buses. And even though she did not believe that the community would actually come out in support of her, it was all that experience with other activists and recognizing that, you know, winning is a possibility in her lifetime that steeled her not just to make the stand, but to continue to stand, in other words, with the movement and with the possibility that they can win. So once you see at least 2, 3, 4, 5, 100 people who are willing to stand with you, that level of confidence makes you feel not like David and Goliath, but like a movement. And movements beget movements. And I think when you think about what Marx and Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto, they envision a new world with such utopian possibilities.
Right.
But that new world was made in a conjuncture when there were people in the streets in 1848 who were actually in motion. In other words, if there was no one in motion, they couldn't have written that text. There's no way.
Robin Kelly, you've written about your own migrations through Marxism on the way to surrealism. Tell us your own story. What drew you and what cautioned, you know, what drew you to Marxism? What soured you? What made you wary? What made you a surrealist?
Well, it's all the same forces. It all comes down to my mother. So even though my mother wasn't so much, she wasn't a communist. I wasn't a red diaper baby. Although one of her best friends, you know, took her to a communist camp when she was in high school. And that probably rubbed off on
That'll
her.
That'll do it.
But, you know, in a sense, if you grow up in a household, and my older sister was very influential. She brought me to Marx more than anyone. If you grow up in a household in which you're supposed to be committed to social justice, and you're supposed to be committed to other people other than yourselves, it's the insistence that you stand outside yourself to understand. And that's what Marx did. I mean, for Marx to understand the working class, because he wasn't working class, he didn't have to become working class. He didn't have to work in the factories to know that, but to sort of understand from their vantage point what they're up against. I mean, Du Bois made that point. King made that point. My mother made that point, you know. And so I was raised with that. Now, the problem was, and this is where Marxism fell short for me, and going through the world and recognizing that historical materialism doesn't explain why people always move. Sometimes they move because they get the Holy Ghost. Sometimes they move because the ancestors tell them to. Sometimes they move because, you know, they go to sleep and dream and they have visions of something different in their lives. And sometimes they move because of love, you know? And all those things are deep emotional journeys really explained for me not just the beauty of surrealism, that is plumbing the unconscious, to try to find resources that are not necessarily the resources you could find in a book or the resources you could find in a set of strategies or tactics, but resources that recognize that we're not just flesh, we're not just people who eat and sleep and need rest, but we're people who are of a spiritual nature, you know, even if you're not religious, of a spiritual nature, whose desires and hungers are tied to things like, you know, convulsive beauty, tied to, you know, being able to enjoy parts of life that cannot be reduced to superstructure or substructure, you know.
So interesting and beautifully said, if I may. I was asking Terry Eagleton, in what sense art is a refuge, or should be a refuge, can be, art, religion, all sorts of spiritual gymnastics from all those contradictions that Marx leaves us with?
That's a question. And it's a hard question, because art also, within the movements that I've been a part of, in the name of Marx, is sometimes treated as propaganda. It's agitprop.
For example?
Well, for example, you know, the proletarian novel, you know, the beauty of those beautiful paintings coming out of Soviet realism of workers enjoying the fruits of life. I mean, look, I'm inspired by that stuff. I like it.
I'm with C.L.R. James. I'll take Thackeray and Dickens, early Dickens.
Yeah, but see, me, I'll take Wilfredo Lam, the great Afro-Cuban painter. Wilfredo Lam has this painting called The Jungle. And The Jungle is like, imagine, you know, your world inside out. You know, that there's some inner demons and inner beauties that all emerge and struggle and wrestle with each other. And to come out of, like, Wilfredo Lam, or Picasso for that matter, part of what they're also struggling with is dialectical. And the dialectics is that the demons of our ancestors, the protectors of our ancestors, that they exist on the same plane, and that there's no way that we're going to build a world where the demons disappear. So how do you live with them?
You're good. But does this mean surrealism and Marxism can coexist in your head, or has surrealism trumped your Marxism by now?
They coexist, and they have to coexist in dialectical tension.
Of course, I set you up for that.
They have to. But see, no, the truth is Marxism was foundational to surrealism. But it's really like Marxism and Freud come together, and they tell a joke. I mean, that's basically it. Hmm. You know, Marx and Freud meet in a bar. That's basically what surrealism is, you know? And trying to figure out, like, you know, what is the value of humor, for example. The value of humor is not to be able to tell a story, to be didactic, but to basically create a kind of convulsive emotional reaction that could raise us up, you know? And that's why I don't think that the utopia that even Marx imagined was one that eliminated all contradictions. The question is, how can we have contradictions that don't kill us?
Here comes the birthday cake, 200 candles. Robin, offer a toast to Brother Marx.
Okay. And by the way, I should mention the fact that my birthday is the day he died. The date he died, not the actual day. March 14th, 1883, he left us. But let me to offer a toast to Karl Marx, who brought us a method of understanding social life and struggle that still has relevance today, and that has driven so many people to dream big dreams.
Thank you, Robin Kelly in Los Angeles. Thank you, Mary Gabriel, Terry Eagleton, and Andrew Hartman. Check our website for a wonderful conversation with Robin Kelly about the great Thelonious Monk at radioopensource.org. While you're up, subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our newsletter, and think of leaving a donation for the best little team in public radio. Our show this week was produced by comrades Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, the artist Susan Coyne, and the drop-in from Amsterdam, Bicycle Mark Rendiro. George Hicks is our engineer, Mary McGrath is our all-purpose commissar. I'm Christopher Blyton. Join us next time on Open Source.